Once upon a time, there was a nation. We'll call it Gerda. It was a destitute, poor nation. Way back before any records were kept, myths and legends told how this nation used to be very rich and productive. But an enemy came and poisoned the land and the waters. Land that used to produce abundant crops would now only produce just a few scraggly weeds. The rivers and lakes that used to quench thirst and water the plants now killed people, animals, and plants. Now the citizens were fortunate if they could find and collect enough weeds to fill their stomachs, even just a little bit. They would collect what little rain fell and ration this out slowly and carefully until the next rains came. Most babies would not live long enough to see their first birthday. Few surviving children would live to see perhaps their teen years, and those who made it to adulthood would hurry and marry and try to produce as many babies as possible before the adults, too, would die at a young age. It was always this way, as the oral legends passed down told them. Although many millennia ago, the myths said the people lived to be hundreds of years old. There was another nation, far to the east, across a huge expanse of ocean. This nation was called Gan Eden. The king and the people of this nation observed the deteriorating conditions of Erda. The Ganedians had compassion upon the Erdians. What could they do? The king decided to send a large shipment of food, vegetables, fruits, and meats, and some water to the Erdians. And so they did. And on the shores of Erda, dozens of crates were unloaded and opened. The Erdians came and watched all the activity on their beach. They saw all these unusual items being unloaded and opened. They saw colorful objects of varying shapes and sizes in each. But what were they? Was it another ploy of the enemy to kill off what remained of them? They were suspicious, and so they did not venture near. The Ganedians left their shipment on the beach and returned to their homes. The shipment of food sat on the beach. After several days, the contents of the crates began to take on an unusual odor, an odor that these Erdians had never before experienced. It was foul, and any of them approaching the containers felt sick. And thus, it became reinforced in their minds that this was the work of the enemy. The Ganedian king, who had messengers in the sky, was told of what had happened. And this greatly saddened him, for he knew that the original Erdians would have known of the fruits and vegetables and meats that he had sent. In fact, it was he who had originally brought the first Erdians to Erda and instructed them on how to live in that land. He had warned them about the enemy and how to avoid him, but they had allowed the enemy to work his evil upon the land and upon them. In a few short generations, they had forgotten all about their origins and what life used to be. All they remembered were foggy myths and legends. The king was determined still to better the lives of the Erdians. He filled another ship with the bounty of the land, outfitted her with a crew, and sent it to Erda. This time, rather than unloading all the containers, a few of the crew took a little of the food and landed on the beach. There, they set up camp, built a fire, and prepared a feast. The Erdians were wary, but soon the wonderful aromas from the cooking wafted over to them. It was quite unlike any of them had ever encountered. It evoked memories of something from their past, from their myths and their legends. It was heavenly. And so a few of the courageous ones ventured toward the camp and the feast. What they saw exceeded their expectations. The Ganedians invited the Erdians to take a seat at the table and to sample the feast. The Ganedians ate, and when the Erdians saw that no harm had come to them, they too took some of the food and ate. And so for 40 days and nights, these few Erdians feasted with the Ganedians. No harm came to any of them, and the once sickly Erdians became healthy and robust. During these 40 days, the Ganedians taught the Erdians how to prepare meals, how to purify water, how to properly preserve foods, and informed them that once a week, they would receive a new shipment of produce and meats. On the final day, a huge feast was prepared to which all Erdians were invited. The now healthy Erdians were sent out to give the invitations to their fellow citizens. Even the most worried and suspicious Urdian, upon seeing the huge positive change that had come to their fellow Urdians, had to accept that the Gnidians were not the enemy. All of the Urdians, about 100 of them, came to the great feast on the beach. At the conclusion of the feast, the Gnidians provided the Urdians with a recipe book. This book contained all of the instructions that were given to them earlier. By following these instructions, they were told, they would become healthy and they would be able to live a long and happy life. And with that, the Gnidians left, promising a new shipment of food every week. For many years, things went well with the Urdians. Those who were taught by the Gnidians in turn taught other Urdians the instructions and methods of preserving and preparing their meals. The Urdians became healthy. Fewer babies and children died. The adults lived longer. Their population increased. The weekly shipment of food from Gnidan was always sufficient to provide for all the Urdians. The enemy, however, saw the changes that were coming to the Urdians, and he was not happy. He couldn't prevent the food shipments, nor could he poison it. So he came up with another idea. He appeared in Urda one day and came to the daily feast. The Urdians had never seen this man before, but they had no reason to be suspicious. He sampled the offerings of the feast and then asked to speak to the Urdian in charge. The enemy suggested a few improvements to the menu and suggested that these be offered to those who would be willing to pay. He suggested the idea of a restaurant. Those who were willing and able to pay would be seated inside for the new and improved dishes. The rest of the Urdians would continue to receive the same old menu items for free. In this way, those who were working so hard to provide for the needs of the rest of the citizens would get something extra, a payment in return. The Urdians working in food preparation and preservation had never thought of that before, but it sure sounded good. After all, they were working hard, and it sure seemed right that they should deserve to get something extra in return. So they built a fancy new building next to the shelters on the beach. They announced that anyone who wanted to pay would get new and improved food. Everyone else would continue to get the old food for free. The recipe book was enshrined in a crystal box and placed in the location of honor at the entrance of the restaurant. Then things began to fall apart quite quickly. The Urdians responsible for food service now spent most of their time in the restaurant. Soon, they only grudgingly provided the free food. They began to resent that so many of the people wouldn't or couldn't pay for the food. They began to spend less and less time preparing the free food. The quantity and quality of the free food available decreased, and soon many of the Urdians were going hungry. The changes to the menu made for the food served at the restaurant weren't without effect, however. It soon became apparent that those who regularly ate at the restaurant were becoming larger. New diseases began to appear among them. As some of them became more wealthy, they began to resent that those who were poorer were able to occasionally come and eat at the restaurant. So the wealthy suggested raising the prices and suggested enforcing a dress code. The restaurant owners readily agreed. They could make more money and keep out the riffraff in all in a single stroke. With the changes that were happening, the quantity of food being served decreased. Only the very wealthy could now afford to eat. The poor would go behind the restaurant and scavenge for whatever they could. Many returned to gathering weeds and collecting rainwater just to survive. Most of the weekly shipments of food just sat there now and rotted. In order to control the foul odor, poorer Urdians were hired to dump the rotting and unused food back into the ocean. And any hired Urdian who tried to take the food being dumped was severely beaten. The Gnidian king heard about what was happening in Urda, and he was very displeased and distressed. With some of his shipments, he sent ambassadors who would search for an Urdian who was dissatisfied with how things were and who also had the courage to do something about it. He would then be reminded that the food belonged to all Urdians, not just the ones who could afford to eat at the restaurant. He was given pictures of what would happen if the Urdians continued to discriminate against one another and what would happen if unhealthy food continued to be served at the restaurant. And so these Urdians, who were instructed by the Gnidian ambassadors, would then go and proclaim the message they had been given. Many of these then organized groups of fellow Earlians to try to raid the food shipments so at least some of it could be used to feed the poor. Over the years, as this happened time after time, some of the restaurant owners would relent and open the neglected shelter next to the restaurant. There they would bring some food to all of the Earlians. Often, it was simply leftovers from the restaurant. On very rare occasions, the restaurant owners would feel particularly remorseful and charitable. And on these occasions, they would get the recipe book down from its place of honor and honor and display, and they would come and prepare a feast at the shelter's kitchen. But this only happened once or twice. Most of the time what happened was that the restaurant owners would get mad at these messengers. They would beat them and even kill them. And then they would go about their usual business. When they realized that the messengers came about as a result of ambassadors arriving with the weekly shipments, they began to take the crew that landed with the shipments, beat them, and sent them back. When messengers still arose among the Erdians, even after beatings of the Gnadian crew, they began to kill some of the crew. The king of Gnadin was appalled at what was happening. What else could he do? There was one last thing he would do. He would covertly send his crown prince into Erda to set up a competing restaurant, one that would serve even better food, but without cost. He would serve the best water and the best drinks, too, all without cost. He would go beyond that, and part of that restaurant would serve as a health center to bring healing to all the people suffering from their various ailments. So on one dark night, in a small raft, the crown prince left the ship of one of the weekly shipments and landed some distance from Erda's restaurant. In the morning, he went to the old shelter, neglected for so long, and began to repair, rebuild, and remodel. He went out to the highways, the alleys, and the slums. He invited them all to the shelter and gave them wonderful, savory food and delicious, refreshing drink. Some of them, realizing the condition of the shelter and seeing the beginnings of the rebuilding process, stayed to help. The restaurant owners looked out their windows and puzzled over what might be happening over by the shelter. They wondered if they should come to put a stop to it, but reasoned that if some fool wanted to offer food, and if they didn't have to work or use their supply of food, it must be okay. Each day, free food and drink was offered. Each day, the crowd grew larger and larger, and the pace of rebuilding and remodeling quickened. Now the restaurant owners were getting a little worried. Some of the wealthy patrons had abandoned the restaurant for the shelter. They said that the food and drink was better, and there was a health retreat center that was helping to cure their ailments. So the restaurant owners came stomping into the shelter, demanding to know from the crown prince who gave him the authority and where he was getting his supplies of food and knowledge of cooking and healing. The crown prince simply answered, "My father." The owners looked at some of the prepared dishes and declared that they weren't according to the recipes given to the Erdians many, many years ago. Therefore, they said, the crown prince was in violation of the law of the land. He must stop and he must leave. The crown prince reminded them that they too were violating their own laws by modifying the recipes that were given to them. In fact, they were doing far worse because they were hoarding the food that had been given to them for free. Not only that, but they were requiring payment in return for the right to have some of the food. And then he said to them, "I will leave, as you demand, only if you will close down your restaurant and offer all Erdians daily feasts for free. I will teach you the new and better recipes and even how to provide healing for the many ailments if you will come and learn from me in my kitchen and in my retreat." Who was this young upstart to claim to know better than they thought to themselves, and who was he to accuse them of violating their own laws? They returned to their restaurant and in their kitchen began to plot ways to get rid of the prince. Meanwhile, word got around that the prince had stood up to the self-proclaimed rulers of Erda, and so more and more Erdians, rich as well as the poor, came to the shelter, now known as the new restaurant. There they feasted and had a great time. Everyone was invited. No one was turned away. Everything was available without cost. Even so, both rich and poor came to offer all they had, their time, their wealth, their services, to further expand and improve the new restaurant. Those who were suffering from hunger were filled. Those who were suffering from overeating at the old restaurant were cured of its effects. There were some who regularly ate at the new restaurant who had become the prince's apprentices. They wondered when they would begin to charge people for the privilege of eating there. After all, the food, the decor, the ambiance, everything was so much better than the old. They could charge quite a bit more, they thought. After all, it seemed so wasteful just to give away so much great food and offer healing for free. The prince answered them, "I'm not like that. In fact, I can't imagine what it is like to be paid for what I give. I exist to give. I exist to serve. If I got paid for it, I would cease to be. I am just like my father. He too exists to give and to serve. And if you really want to exist and to be forever, you too must learn to give and serve and expect nothing in return." Now I want to go to John chapter 12. I'm going to read verses 1 through 19. "Then, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus lived, whom he had raised from the dead. So they prepared a dinner for Jesus there. Martha was serving, and Lazarus was among those present at the table with him. Then Mary took 3/4 pound of expensive aromatic oil from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus. She then wiped his feet dry with her hair. Now the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfumed oil. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one who was going to betray him, said, 'Why wasn't this oil sold for 300 silver coins and the money given to the poor?' Now Judas said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money box, he used to steal what was put into it. So Jesus said, 'Leave her alone. She has kept it for the day of my burial. For you will always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me.' Now a large crowd of Judeans learned that Jesus was there, and so they came, not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests planned to kill Lazarus too, for on account of him, many of the Jewish people from Jerusalem were going away and believing in Jesus. The next day, the large crowd that had come to the feast heard that Jesus was coming to Jerusalem. So they took branches of palm trees and went out to meet him. They began to shout, 'Hosanna, blessed is he, is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the King of Israel.' Jesus found a young donkey and sat on it, just as it is written, 'Do not be afraid, people of Zion. Look, your king is coming, seated on a donkey's colt.' His disciples did not understand these things when they first happened. But when Jesus was glorified, then they remembered that these things were written about him and that these things had happened to him. So the crowd who had been with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead were continuing to testify about it. Because they had heard that Jesus had performed this miraculous sign, the crowd went out to meet him. Thus the Pharisees said to one another, 'You see that you can do nothing. Look, the world has run off after him.'" This is a story of a feast within a feast. Jesus comes to the Passover feast, and immediately before that, a feast is prepared in his honor because he had raised Lazarus. It's a feast of thanks by Mary, by Martha, and Lazarus for what Jesus had done. And I don't know how many of you were here when I talked about the other feast that's in Luke where Jesus is anointed by a woman. But these feasts that are held, everyone is invited. You know, the whole town. Anyone passing through town, all the guests are invited. And so, being Passover and being 2 miles away from Jerusalem, you know, there may have been hundreds, even thousands, who came to see Jesus. during this feast. What we see in these two stories of Jesus' anointing at the feast and triumphal entry are two types of, or different types of people and their faith. Mary is given as the kind of a model of faith that John wants to present to his readers. Mary, you can almost picture as almost a type of Christ, because in this whole narrative, she's the one who acts the part of the servant. She's the one who washes Jesus' feet. Now in both Matthew and Mark, both of those writers give Mary as anointing Jesus' head. Given the quantity of the ointment or the perfume, it's entirely possible that Mary covered Jesus completely with this perfume, from head to toe. But John chooses to emphasize the feet. What's interesting is that in the very next chapter, Jesus doesn't get his feet washed at all. See, Jesus gets his feet washed in this story. Of all the disciples, of all the followers that Jesus had, Mary is the one who seems to get it. She seems to be the only one who understands that, you know, for whatever reason, Jesus is going to depart from them. And so she takes what she believes is her last opportunity to do the one act of service that emphasizes the true nature of service in that culture. And feet were considered unclean. They were dirty. No one who wished to be clean touched someone else's feet. But here is Mary washing Jesus' feet. And although 300 silver coins, 300 denarii, which could be $10,000 or $20,000 in today's terms, a full year's wage for at minimum wage basically is what it is. To her, it was cheap. She received salvation. And so to her, a full year's wage was nothing. On the other hand, Judas. We want to talk about attitude. The parenthetical note in the passage that we just read, the perfume, the fragrance went out through the entire room. Mary's perfume represents perhaps her attitude. It literally perfumed the room. But her example spreads to all the world. On the other hand, the attitude of Judas, the stench, stinks. Well, it's all about me. It's all about appearances. I find Jesus' response interesting. Where he says, "You'll always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me." I think what he's saying is that acts of service, however good it may be, if it's simply for the sake of serving, in order to get something out of it, is worthless. Now, social action, apart from the cross, what Jesus is saying to us, saying to Judas, saying to all his disciples, is meaningless. Social action, service, must be because of the attitude that because Jesus served me first, because I want to serve Jesus, I will serve others. Each of the two narratives, you know, the feast in Bethany and the triumphal entry narrative that we just read, ends with the response of either the priests or the Pharisees. Notice, they know Jesus is the Messiah. They have no questions about it. But because he is not what they want, they choose not to believe, and they choose to act on it. Well, the priests have become so irrational that now they're going to kill Lazarus too. At least that's their plan. And then after the triumphal entry, when it seems all of Jerusalem is following Jesus, the Pharisees kind of throw their hands up in the air and say, "You see, there's nothing we can do now. The only thing left for us is for destruction to fall upon us." And in fact, whenever anyone works against God's purposes, they will be destroyed. Now it may be you that gets destroyed. The priests and the Pharisees, they were so committed to remaining right in their theology that they would do anything, even though they knew they were wrong. Saving face was the most important thing for them. In these two narratives, we see once again Jesus offering the free gift of grace, the priceless gift of grace, infinite gift of grace, free, the free bread of life, free living water, a free invitation to the wedding feast. So, what do we do with this free gift of God? Hoard it? Charge for it? Enforce a dress code, a behavior code? Do we throw it away? Do we let it sit and rot? Or do we take some for ourselves and then invite others to share? Do you realize today what kind of gift it is that Jesus has given you? Do you really, truly appreciate it? The gospel of Jesus becomes the gospel when we share it. Believe if we simply keep it to ourselves, it's no longer the gospel. And so, once again, question for this morning is, what are you going to do with the gift? What am I going to do with the gift?